Welcome to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Florida Bar Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his field of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's program, entertainment lawyers at the Root of Things provide legal advice, counsel, and representation to businesses and individuals in the entertainment industries, including the fields of theater, television, film, music, publishing, and digital media. Typically, entertainment lawyers focus on transactional and litigation. Today, from the law firm of Ticino and Shammy, we have Brenda Shammy. But first, I'd like to welcome the legal panel for today. Filling in for Gary Singer, who's somewhere in the Mediterranean, is civil court judge from the 17th Circuit Court, the Honorable Judge Jeff Levinson. Thank you for filling in, Judge.
Happy to be here.
Appreciate it very much as well.
And congratulations on your recent marriage.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Can you believe it? At my age, someone actually loves me now. And, of course, Eric Yankowit. Eric, always a pleasure.
It's always nice to see you again, yep. Phil, especially when you pronounce my name right.
Yankowit?
Eventually he'll get it right.
That's You're like
right.
the IRS. You're yeah. here to help.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But also, welcome to our listeners on 96.9 FM, 103.9 FM, 740 AM, WSBR, along with national listeners on iHeart, TuneIn, and iRadio Now. And don't forget to check out our podcast. Just Google Legal News and Review, Podcast Apple, and we come right up. And on Thursdays, you can actually watch the show produced live on Facebook Live. Just Google Facebook, Legal News and Review, and you can actually see past programs as well. You'll see we're recording today at the Kelly Ustahl Building in their very own mock courtroom. You talk about amazing resources and successes. If you've been severely injured by someone else's negligence, go to justiceforall.com. That's justiceforall.com. You know, entertainment lawyers must be well-versed in a variety of legal fields with so many possible problems and opportunities that the entertainment world presents. Brenda Shammy from the law firm of Ticino Shammy, welcome.
Thank you.
And you practice intellectual property law, but you focus also on entertainment. Is that correct?
That's correct. Our business specializes in business and intellectual property law. And under that large umbrella, entertainment is one of the big areas we focus on.
Well, my first question is, what does an entertainment lawyer do besides being entertained?
Sure. So, We usually say that being an entertainment lawyer is really just a category under the business and IP umbrella. It's a business and intellectual property lawyer that has a lot of experience and knowledge about the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. So there's no such thing as entertainment law in the sense that there's no body of law specific to entertainment, but rather things like copyright law.
Right.
Or labor law.
I'm sorry?
And labor law.
Labor law or, you know, business contract drafting, negotiating, things of that nature. So there's no, you know, entertainment law, but rather all of these different areas of law that you bring into the entertainment industry.
Well, what actually mentioned copyright? What is a copyright?
Sure. So, and actually, if you want to take one step back, we can differentiate between trademarks and copyrights because I tend to find that a lot of people get those two mixed up. So a trademark, the best way to think about that is that the trademark is a way to protect your brand. So think about the name of a company, the logo. You can actually trademark sounds. You can trademark colors and a few other intricate things. However, trademarks are meant to protect a brand, whereas the copyright is meant to protect a body of work. So that could be anything from song lyrics to art to photographs, works of literature. Things like that are protected under copyright, where, like I said, brands are protected under trademarks.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
So typically lawyers are categorized by litigators or by transactional lawyers. And in particular, you have litigation experience from the very beginning. Do you combine those two disciplines? In other words, if your client has issues and they need to go to court, are you able to do that? Do you do the litigation part?
Absolutely. It's actually my favorite part. Negotiation and litigation is where I thrive. My partner, on the other hand, has a lot more experience in the transactional side, which is why we're such a great complement.
Is it mostly in state court or federal court?
We do both. Most of the intellectual property matters tend to be in federal court, but it can vary. And then some of the, you know, local contracts that some of our influencers may do or things like that, those sometimes are in state court. So it depends.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go for it. That's why you're here as well.
He should be interrupted once in a while.
What actually is the term fair use? What does that actually mean?
So that's an interesting question, and I think that there's actually not a clear answer because, like everything in the law, it's a
great
term.
Wait a minute. You're an attorney?
I'm an attorney, and I said there's no.
It depends?
It depends.
It's unfair use.
It's the first class in law schools. It depends.
Yeah.
Exactly. So fair use is basically a defense used when a copyright, for example, can be used by the general public because of the, and there's different ways that you can look at fair use. One of the things we are currently dealing with is an issue of fair use based on dilution. So essentially somebody that never enforced their brand, somebody that it's just, you know, all over. So an easy example would be, why can't I think of this artist's name? Andy Warhol?
Oh, sure.
Right.
Campbell's Soup.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And how many times that's been reproduced. And usually the reason that that's able to be reproduced is because of the fair use doctrine.
When it comes to your practice, because you do practice internationally as well, especially with your partner. He goes back and forth to Italy.
Does
he was on our show before.
Must be nice.
Yeah, must be nice as well.
How do you get that job?
But because of the new treaties, an example would be, I understand the treaty in Mexico has real teeth. If I produce Louis Vuitton bags, you know, some bogus bags and send it here to a flea market, and I get caught in Mexico, I'm going to go to jail, not be fined. They're going to lock me away.
Correct. I think especially in today's market where most brands are now global brands, and there's not so much of a separation, whereas maybe before, you know, now because of the internet, because of e-commerce, because of just how easy it is to get around, most brands are now all over the world. And so I think things like this treaty and the ability to enforce worldwide as opposed to just locally has become incredibly relevant.
Would you think that criminal penalties would act more as a deterrent than the civil penalties?
So that goes into a more philosophical question than I.
Well, you ever seen pictures of a Mexican jail?
Well, we also have our laws
to
prosecute these type of cases. Sometimes because they don't deem it to be as serious, they defer to civil enforcement. But it can be very serious and it can be very costly to the manufacturer, to those that own the copyright.
Absolutely understood. And on a personal level, I don't necessarily think that things like copyright infringement should raise to a criminal level. That's a personal.
Well, the Supreme Court recently ruled that you could use offensive language and get it, I guess, trademarked or even copyrighted. Is that correct?
That's correct. So that was actually a very recent decision that had a lot to do with, obviously, freedom of speech, right? And the idea that previously you couldn't copyright something that was seen as scandalous. So bad words being scandalous.
I know one judge said about pornography, I know it when I see it.
Oh, well.
Justice Byron Whizzer White.
Thank
there you.
You. Thank you. I always wonder who it was. I always say the wrong justice.
I believe that's who it was.
Yeah. Well, you're the judge. I'll refer to you.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's actually, for IP attorneys, revolutionary. Because, especially with controversy being such a great tool to market a product.
Sure.
A lot of time, you can trademark slogans, you can trademark brand names, you can trademark so many things. And so
colors,
all those things. So a lot of our clients, especially because we work with a lot of younger clients, will use scandalous, provocative slogans, phrases, words to promote their products. And previously they couldn't own that because, the USPTO wouldn't allow them to. And so this decision is going to, I think...
Open a lot of doors. Well, is there a place that you can register your trademark worldwide?
Worldwide, no. So there is the Madrid Protocol, which is essentially a one-stop shop for a list of countries. It's not actually all countries, but it's a good amount. But even through that, it's still you have to pick and choose which ones you want. So it's not, you know, like when you were applying to college and it was like the Common App and you just, it's somewhat like that. But you still do need to choose which countries you want to do. You pay fees separately for the different countries. But it is a more one stop as opposed to having to individually reach out to attorneys in each country.
The concern I have that I get from my clients actually is like, okay, if I trademark my stuff here in the States, how's it going to be enforced in China?
Well, it's not.
How about the European Union?
Right, that's the Madrid Protocol. So that's why. But you still have to register it there, right? So, you know, just because here in the US you have something registered in Madrid, if not to be redundant because it's called the Madrid Protocol, but I don't know, in Greece, they're not going to enforce your U.S. Trademark unless you're registered in Greece.
So how do you get yourself protected from China?
You can register in China. We do it for our clients all the time.
Okay, so there is a registry in China. And they respect it. And
every country has their, you know, trademark registration process. And we work with a lot of, you know, aside from that group of countries that we can do through the U.S., which is under that Madrid Protocol. There's a list of countries. I don't know them off the top of my head. There's, I think, more than 20. But then the ones that aren't, we have attorneys in those different countries that we collaborate with, and essentially they'll file the same way we would file here.
Well, in movies and television, at the end, they do all this, you know, announcing, you know, this person was a director, this person was a grip, and things like that. And I understand legally they have to. Is that really true?
Yes. So producer credits, whether it be in music and TV and in movies, that's all negotiated. And a lot of times you'll actually see producer credits for people that are not producers, that didn't actually produce the show, but instead negotiated those rights. And maybe the amount that they produced is nominal at most, but it's one of the perks that they negotiated into their contract.
Almost like they put their name on a building.
Literally. Okay. Yeah. So it's not always, you know, everything's not as it seems in the sense that a very small bit of work could be done. Sometimes publishing companies will take a producer royalty, even though they're obviously not producers.
Right.
And in TV, it happens a lot, right? Where season one, they don't get anything, and you negotiate, well, if I get to season three, I'd like a producer credit. I mean, maybe at some point they did some sort of, you know, commentary and that helped the production, but I don't know. You know.
But they get also residual, the smart ones. People that were part of, like, Gilligan's Island got nothing, you know? And when we talk
about... You know that for a fact.
I know that for a fact. They didn't get any residual
island
with all the reruns.
Many of your viewers or your listeners may not know what Gilligan's Island is, but that's okay.
That could be. But I'll tell you one thing. When we talk about offensive language, I grew up in an era where they couldn't even show a belly button on Gilligan's Island.
You certainly are dating yourself.
I really am. But some of my listeners could relate to that. Now, when it comes to technology, such as apps. I've got a lot of apps on here. Matter of fact, I have ideas for apps. You know, that's going to make me a lot of money, so you better be nice to me, Judge. But in all seriousness, how is that copywritten trademark? Is there's algorithm? I mean, that to me is complex. It's overwhelming.
Yeah, so I get asked at least once a week, how do I protect my idea? You cannot protect an idea. What you can protect are the things around the idea. You can protect the name. You can protect the code of the app. And that's, you know, a conversation that we have sometimes with our developers. Do you want to do that? Because then it becomes public information. Mm-hmm. When you register a copyright, you submit the code. And so legally you can, but as a business decision, you may not want to.
During the pendency of that submission, can someone then utilize that? Can they access that? In other words, you say you're concerned about displaying it in the public realm.
Sure.
But if by virtue of the fact that you did register, doesn't that protect you in some way?
To an extent, right? Because think of Uber and Lyft, right? You can change some things and maybe not be infringing, but get the core of what that app does or the technology that you're seeking to then replicate. So technically, yes, and not to say that you wouldn't maybe have a very valid claim for copyright infringement, but depending on the app and what you're doing, for strategic reasons, you may choose not to.
Is that what happened with Uber and Lyft? Is that an example?
No, I only use Uber and Lyft because I usually have this conversation with my clients about whether they want to copyright their app, you know, their code or not. And sometimes my advice to them is, instead of trying to protect everything, sometimes you can't. And so what you do is you're just the strongest, fastest, and best at what you do. And you're first to market, and then you're the Uber of Uber, right? You're the Band-Aid of Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. And so there may be other Band-Aids, but everyone's still calling it Band-Aid, right?
It's a tough call.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's a business decision, not necessarily a legal one.
Right.
Now, the artists you represent play live music, live shows. And is it recommended to have a written contract between the venue and the band for any performance?
I'm a lawyer, so I'm a big fan of contracts in general.
Yes.
Write it down. Mainly because I'm a big fan of being clear on what's expected of both sides. And I always, you know, I always tell my business clients or even my artists, mm-hmm. because to me, a band is a business. It's like a prenup, and I'm a big fan of prenups. And the reason is that let's make a deal while I love you.
Yeah.
Because then we're both trying to get what's best for everyone, right? Whereas if we're already fighting and we have to figure out what we had originally agreed to, it's going to be much muddier. And so the more that we can get on the same page, put it in writing ahead of time, the better. With musicians in particular, it depends on their situation. Are they represented by a label? Do they have a manager? Are they independent? Because, you know, it's unless you're a smaller artist, you're usually having the label do the deals with the venues or your team in general. And the much smaller artists maybe can't afford to do those contracts. But sometimes, you know, even just very clearly laying out expectations at the very minimum is, please, it'll save you a lot of trouble.
Why wouldn't you want a contract?
Yeah.
Sometimes a contract binds you to things that you may not want to then be responsible for.
Or it may scare away the venue. They may not say, "I don't want to get into that." It's a leap of faith, I guess. But
both ways.
Yeah. I mean, what I find in litigation is it's the litigators are stuck with the mistakes that are made by the transactional lawyers. You know, I will always say it would be nice if those that drafted the contract could come to court and watch what mischief they've caused. You know,
and you're absolutely right. And I think that that's why, you know, I'm very fortunate that my partner and I come from such different backgrounds. He's really big on, you know, the law and the study and the drafting and all of that. And I'm more of the litigator. So I'm more strategic thinking and, okay, how do we work around this problem? Or, hey, I've seen this problem before. Let's anticipate it now.
And you know that if there's a problem with the contract, you know who to go to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
When it comes to working with artists, a lot of them are called starving artists. How can they afford you or your firm?
Interesting. So depending on the situation, it's not uncommon for entertainment lawyers to actually take a percentage of gross revenue for artists.
It's always the gross. I noticed that.
It is always the gross.
It's an easy way calculation to figure things out. Otherwise,
so says our
efficiency.
Cat
here. Efficiency here. So in certain circumstances, what I had mentioned to you earlier is one of the luxuries that I have mm-hmm. is that I, being absolutely not a talent scout, get to make a decision based on how much I believe in someone, right? And so I have the luxury to take on an artist who I really think, mm-hmm. you know, this is the next superstar and bet on them essentially. Because at the beginning of their career, when we're just taking a percentage of their gross revenue and their gross revenue is zero, that's a pretty easy math calculation that we have to do and we get zero. So, you know, sometimes lawyers gamble too. But it's a leap of faith. And then sometimes there are certain clients that maybe don't want us on board for everything. They may just come to us, hey, I just need this one agreement because it's the biggest agreement I'm a part of.
Right.
Or this one trademark. Or, hey, can you just copyright my catalog? And that's perfectly fine. We work with a lot of influencers as well. And you know, sometimes it's I can handle my own day-to-day kind of, you know, contracts, but I'm going to do this huge deal and I'd like to talk to you. And so, you know, not everyone is built for that revenue model, you know,
right.
where we can kind of work that out. Sometimes it's a flat fee, sometimes it's hourly. And so we have the luxury of being a boutique firm, so we can be flexible.
So not one size fits all.
Exactly.
So how does the labor part of the contract work out? Because there are some days, I imagine, some contracts, they you can't make them work when they're sick. They have holidays, they're working. There's all sorts of different variations. I can't imagine all the different variables.
So artists aren't actually employees of the venue.
Right.
So they're not. So they're contracting them as a business. So it's more almost as, more. Think of it more as like an event that the venue is putting on.
Okay.
So there's less labor involved than you would think, mainly because they're not employees.
When they're performing, they look like they're working.
They're absolutely working, but they're not working for the venue.
I see.
They're independent contractors. They're really not.
Exactly. So that's not to say that what you're talking about isn't relevant, right? Because if, you know, American Airlines Arena puts on a concert and Taylor Swift is sick and can't sing, that presents a problem. And so those situations are absolutely contemplated in the agreements that we negotiate, just not necessarily from an employment point of view, more from almost like a force majeure kind of.
Or in the contract, you're going to talk about the conditions from which they're going to perform, all the different things that they need in the dressing room,
oh, yeah.
what they need on stage and so forth. And the more specificity, the more that they'll be able to get what they want.
Oh, yeah. Riders are super fun. Riders are basically the artist requirements, the red Skittles, the only pink Starburst.
Right.
And like all of a sudden, I went to law school to negotiate what color Starburst needs to be in a dressing room, and that's okay.
It's my understanding that even, you know, professional speakers are even worse. You know, they have certain demands and requirements. You know, when they get out there, that things have to be done a certain way. You can't say something, you can't do something. But that's all part of the contractual negotiation.
Absolutely, yeah. And we encounter that sometimes with interviews. You know, when our TV or movie clients will go do interviews and there's
right.
certain can't say this, can't do that. And so a lot of the time, you know, we work with a lot of managers and they'll come to us and they'll say, hey, this is a no-go, right? And so we make sure that all of that is legally
negotiated. What about getting
them
out of contracts? I mean, I hear and I've seen movies and so forth that these people like Elvis or the Beatles were held to a contract that made them nothing.
100%. I'm currently doing that for two of my clients. And it is, it's hard because a lot of clients, especially at the beginning, will sign something just for the sake of being under, you know, oh, I got a label deal, right? And they
right.
will sign their life away. And that is a very long deal. And now all of a sudden they've evolved as artists. They've gotten a network of people and real opportunities for growth, and they can't take advantage of them unless we find some way to sometimes negotiate out of a contract, sometimes find, you know, ways that the contract is invalid or, you know, settle or whatever the case may be. Every circumstance is obviously very different, but it's very, very common that young artists, and I don't mean young in age, I mean young in where they are in the industry, will sign on to contracts that are just impossible.
You know, we only have really about 2 minutes left. And one of the things I like about you is your passion when you're able to help somebody achieve their dream. You know, the creative work is so difficult and you're usually alone with it as well. But, you know, having you and your firm behind you. And again, I like the aspect that not one size fits all. You know, some artists are making millions of dollars, of course they're going to pay you a generous fee for your work, and rightly so. But those that are struggling, that you give the opportunity to, and I know we're not going to mention names, but that must be
I guess you don't want to mention any names, right?
No.
You know, we are running out of time, and I want to make sure that our listeners get the chance to give you a call. What's the best way of reaching you?
Yeah.
Sure. So there's a few different ways. One is obviously you can Google us. DS Miami is the short form for Deschino and Shammy. DS Miami, yeah.
D as in dog, S as in Sam.
D as in dog, S as in Sam, Miami.com is actually our website, or you can just Google it. My name again is Brenda Shammy. We also have an Instagram, which is @DS_Miami. So any of those ways, you can email us. I'm personally, you can email me, brenda@dsmiami.com. Or find us, like I said, on Google, Deschino and Chamois, or again, DS Miami for short.
And also, if you want to review this program, you could check out our podcasting. Just Google, which is my friend, Legal News and Review, Podcasting Apple. We come right up and you can see and hear all the different programs.
Let's hope you have copyright protection.
Uh-oh. Well, on that note, first of all, Judge, we appreciate you coming in. You're going to be on the program for the whole month while Gary Singer is enjoying, I guess, the good life.
Okay.
Yeah, you didn't know that because you got your car keys. You ain't leaving.
Okay.
And Brenda, we appreciate you taking the time.
Loved being here. Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed this as well. And, of course, Eric, what would a show be without you?
I shudder the thing.
I want to thank our producers as well, Mike Lubitz and Giovanni Lopez. It's been a good program. And remember,
be legal!
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448. For legal news and review, remember, be legal.
Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310. Or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.